Well, hello and welcome to the Adoption and Fostering Podcast Wednesday webcast with me, Scott Cassin-Rennie, himself,
Al Coates.
And tonight we are joined by Fran and Ellie, as you can see on the screen. So we're just going to get you to quickly introduce yourself, and then Al has a public service announcement. So Fran, introduce yourself. Tell us what you, who you are and what you're doing here tonight.
Hi, my name is Fran Morgan. I run an organisation called Square Peg, which exists to effect change for children who face barriers to school attendance. And I'm a parent with lived experience of that.
Thank you, Fran. And Ellie?
I'm Ellie Costello. I am a director at Square Peg alongside Fran. She pulled me by the back of my hair to join her. And I'm also a parent with lived experience as well in the area of, barriers to school attendance.
Fab. Right. So no disrespect. We'll come back to you in just a minute. As you know, Al has a public service announcement he needs to make, and we can really rib him afterwards when he gets it all wrong. So Al, over to you.
Okay, right. On the 12th of March, we are going to run we're running a small practice learning event for parents, carers, foster carers, kinship carers, anyone who kind of has some sort of role for caring for children. And we're going to be looking specifically at supporting children and families who live with children who've got like challenging, violent or aggressive behaviour. That is going to be £25 for a ticket. You get that's for a full morning. That's 9:30 till 12:30. That is going to be available afterwards. You can ask questions beforehand. And if you want to find how to do that, there'll be a link somewhere on the Facebook page, wherever you're watching, and you can access that and join us through Eventbrite. Boom. I think I hit every single one of my marks that time, Scott.
You did make an error. But all right, okay. We seem to be making it shorter and shorter every week. So it's now 9:30 to 12:30. It started off as 9 to 1. It's now 9:30 to 12:30. I think we can say the time is flexible on this event.
It's like 10 minutes.
But we'll be finished by lunchtime. Let's put it that way. Whatever time your lunchtime is.
Oh, fantastic. Cool.
Thank you for that, Al. That was much better. Well done. Congratulations. Well, there was no pressure there at all, was there?
By the time we get to the event, I'll have got it down just perfect. Right, okay. So I'm really interested in this conversation, but before we even start, Fran and Ellie, I want to say that I'm really sorry because I used the language of school refusal, and I got a virtual smack on the back of their hand. So tell me, but a lot of people from our community, sort of, you know, foster care, sort of adoption, that just trips off the tongue. There's no emotion to that. It's just school refusal. Children.
Yeah.
So tell me why I'm wrong.
Okay. You're not wrong. But it's the term that most people recognise. But the trouble with refusal is that it implies willful choice. And a lot of these children just can't. It's not that they won't, they can't. And it also puts the problem on the child as the refuser. So there are many, many different terms for it. But the one that we have come around to is barriers to school attendance, because that just feels more, it encompasses children who are excluded as well as those who school refuse. It doesn't put the problem on the child, it puts the problem somewhere else, and the job is to find out where.
I think also as well, we're keen to upend the narrative that, you know, and to invite the inquiry as to what's driving the behaviour and naming the need and really sitting and sort of getting curious about that. And all too often that doesn't happen, or parents and families are blamed or accused of sort of adding to the problem through being anxious or whatever. Mm-hmm. So we're really just wanting to take the heat out of it and make it a much more grounded phrase that's a bit more ethical, I suppose, and compassionate.
And if you include anxiety in the phrase, the trouble with that is that everyone gets anxious, so it can be quite easily dismissed. You just have to get over it. You know, everyone gets anxious. It's just so hence not using that word, although that is often nearly always the trigger. Yeah.
I mean, we were chatting just before we came on air. That makes it sound, it's not that exotic. As we tried to fight our way onto the internet through the technicalities. And you were saying that you were talking about there being 39, up to 39 different ways of describing this phenomena. What's that all about?
Don't,
what are they?
You're not going to ask me what they are. Oh, please. No. Yeah. That's not fair. No, there's all sorts of, emotionally based school avoidance, extended non-attendance. There's a couple for you. I'll have to send you the rest in the post because I can't remember them all. That's but lots funny. Of terms used in academia to describe this issue, yeah.
I think that also evidences the confusion around it professionally, and that actually clinicians have really struggled to identify what it's about in a way that everyone's aware of it. But what that evidence is for me is that there really is no simple answer to it, actually. The triggers that cause it are as unique as the child that's experiencing it. And it can be environmental, or it can be social, or it can be, you know, but it sits, the sort of common themes, I think, are a trauma response to school or something attached to school that actually disables the child's ability to feel safe and access school. So it's really subtle and complex, but also there are other factors that drive attendance difficulties, including poverty and insecure housing, all sorts. There are so many reasons, as well as the usual flags such as bullying and
It is do you have a rough idea of the scale of the problem? I mean, within our, I guess, Scott, you're probably more familiar than I, because Scott's got his finger on the pulse, haven't you, Scott?
Apparently so.
you probably have a better...
I think when we're looking at teens and later teens, so looking at high school in terms of this issue, it's quite prevalent, actually. But it doesn't necessarily reflect the figures in terms of exam results and BTEC qualifications, all that sort of stuff, because actually some schools have been really good at trying to find ways around that kind of avoidance. I mean, my experience would be in kind of the teen years, if you like, and then on going on to further education and then on to work. And in some ways we could say, you know, there's kind of an issue with young people within the cohort that we discussed in and out, kind of been averse to engaging with employment and things like that. You know, I'm not saying that I have any personal experience of that with my young adults at all, but it's kind of, if it's something that we're aware of earlier, then it can help as we go through those years. Is it more of a problem in teen years? Is it, you know, where are we sitting with that?
It often starts very, very early, nursery or primary. That's what the parents in the Not Fine in School group tell us. There are cliff faces like going into secondary school. And the numbers, you asked about the scale of the problem. 771,863 persistent absentees, which is the only official measure of absence, 750,000 children. And when you compare that to the number of children excluded, there are, I think, 199,000 who've had one fixed period exclusion. And if you take out the ones who've had only one, you're down to about 80,000. So when you compare, it's just, I mean, I say that number so often and it still shocks me that it's such an invisible issue.
And there's so many unhelpful narratives alongside it. You can get swept up with truancy. All sorts of really quite outdated concepts are suddenly thrown at you as a family. And the sort of lines of inquiry and the queries that go, you know, the assessments and the initial sort of early help engagement, if you're lucky enough to be able to access that at all, are all of them are, it's a very old-fashioned, presumptuous, archaic response, I think, that really doesn't help with understanding what's driving it and what's increasing it as well, because it's going to escalate in the pandemic without the shadow of a doubt will bring new cohorts that perhaps for whatever reason are maybe just clinging on, but you know, fall off another cliff edge.
Yeah, well, I was going to ask about that actually, because during COVID, I suppose it's difficult to tell because each school has different numbers and, you know, whether they're engaging with, you know, are we looking into, not we as in a group, I mean, generally, are we looking into those who potentially are working better online, who maybe, you know, didn't enjoy going to school, et cetera, et cetera. Is that something that's, are we seeing an increase, a decrease? Do we know? Is anybody interested? Apart from you guys, obviously.
We tried to kickstart a research project to do exactly that. What we do know, the group that I mentioned, Not Fine in School, that supports those parents, we do know from that membership that it was growing at sort of 600 to 800 a month pre-pandemic and then completely flatlined at the end of March. Right. I think they lost about 90 members in 3 months. So that gives you an indication that with the pressure off, pressure of fines and prosecutions and pressure of school attendance, a lot of parents found life easier.
Yeah.
And anecdotally, there were things like, you know, my child has come back to me after years away, and my child is engaging with online learning without that pressure of having to be at school.
Yeah. Can I ask how you, as an organisation, started? Because you, like you said, that Not Fine in School is a support, specifically supports parents. That's not what you're specifically doing, is it? So can you give them a bit of a backstory as to how you got involved in this world, and then what your hope and aspiration is with Square Pegs?
Okay, well, I'll start, and then pass over to Ellie. So I've been in this world for about 12 years because my youngest didn't fit the system. And she didn't fit the system because she's really strong-willed. She's very bright, but she's very strong-willed, and she liked to challenge things, and that doesn't work in this system. So I got involved then. She was in year four, and she fell off the cliff in secondary school. So I've done parent support, and I've been co-chair of a parent carer forum. And a few years ago, I thought, I can't do support anymore. We have to have some change. We have to effect change. So that's what Square Peg is about. So we work very closely with Not Fine in School, and that's our evidence base, if you like. It means that we can hear on the ground on a daily basis the sort of problems people are having. So that started as a social enterprise at the back end of 2018, early 2019, became a KIC in spring last year when Ellie was already on board and then became a director. So in 2 years, I mean, it's gone a bit mental, which is an indication of the scale of the problem and the consequences for children and families when this happens. And that enforced attendance narrative and the fear. I can remember when my daughter struggled again at secondary school at the end of the first term. And the only person I knew well was the Senko. And I rang her and she said, let's keep this between us just for now. And I thought, this doesn't sound good. This isn't going to go well. And it's that fear, because she knew the consequences that very quickly we would be threatened with fines and etc. You kind of have the fear of God put into you quite early on.
I mean, it's worth pointing out, I mean, this is across all children. It's not just adoption fostering. You know, this is something that goes on. It's a little bit like challenging and aggressive behavior. You know, it goes on in what I would refer to as normal families as well. So it's not just adoption and fostering, which must really open you up to quite a large community in terms of who would be, you know, who'd be looking for signposting, or I want to say a typical family. I mean, you're both sitting there, you're probably typical families, but just describe a typical family that might in that position.
I think attendance difficulties aren't selective. So you can't actually identify it according to socioeconomic, although there are issues and challenges for certain groups that will make them more vulnerable to attendance difficulties. but I think also it can happen to anybody for whatever reason. A family may experience a single traumatic event, a car accident, anything might be just one significant event that would then trigger a trauma response in the child or young person, so that they would be find it very difficult to separate from primary caregiver. And if school aren't alert to that and don't get it right, it's very quick for those secure attachments or that sense of safety or even that anxious brain to get overactive and for the problems to start. And I think what's happening or happened at the moment, so if I just talk a little bit about sort of our journey, we entered the education system at a point where the coalition had just come in. Gove was going into the DfE. A lot of changes were happening very quickly, with budget cuts happening, support services just being slashed overnight, attainment levels just literally going up by 2 years. We had a cultural change within our own primary, where we had the old head go retire and new heads came in at a time when behavior management charts, learning boards, traffic light systems were starting to be used. And both my kids had a history of medical trauma from infancy onwards, which disrupted their attachment and went undiagnosed for 9 years for my son. We subsequently discovered a lot clinically was going on, medically, but it was all invisible, all hidden, but, you know, a plethora of genetic stuff going on. And so because we look like that normal family, that 2.2 stable, you know, middle England family, we didn't hit radars very readily. And also, I think a lot of mothers are really good at coping for a long time. So the one thing about school refusal, I use that phrase, sorry, it just slips off the tongue as you say. But the one thing about it is that by the time the school really get to see it, invariably the writing's been on the wall for a very long time. So at home behind closed doors, they've been coping for a long time, trying to either manage meltdown behaviors, you know, Coke bottle syndrome or whatever at home, or there's just little sort of niggles that just and I think as children are passing through the rigor of what primary education has become, and their resilience and their capacity is reducing at the same time. If you've got a child who was already coming from a more vulnerable starting point, they're going to hit a flashpoint, and younger than perhaps your average child. But I think it really doesn't. It's not selective. That's the thing. You can't really predict. It can happen to anyone. And it certainly wasn't on my game plan. It wasn't part of the agenda when I became a mum. And it was just so shocking to experience, firstly, the challenge as a parent, but also the response system from the systems around us, including education, social care, healthcare, mental health care. And to then be lost at sea with systems that are broken at a time where there was a huge amount of political change going on and ideological change and all the rest of it, and budgets being cut. So I think there's been a real perfect storm. And now we have the pandemic as well. And now, but off the back of that, what's really to find the positives is that trauma-aware conversations are now more commonplace.
Yeah.
Fran and I have had the busiest 3 or 4 months since the narrative around enforced attendance has suddenly hit the press in new ways. When we've been talking about it for years, it's much more out there. It's much more, and new cohorts of families have experienced from September in the pandemic, when we kept schools fully reopened, have experienced that full force of expectations around attendance that those families may not have hit that difficulty.
I was going to take you back, and you were talking about this almost families finding themselves perhaps like moving from a position of perhaps where they've needed support to almost into the perpetrator role, that like a shift of, you know, you, we're helping you, but all of a sudden you're the problem. It's not good parenting. It's So is that part of your campaign? I mean, is your campaign trying to shift that narrative to somewhere else, and where else?
I think we do need to improve the understanding of this issue. And when we survey parents in the group, the proportion of parents that feel blamed and judged is huge. It's huge. Mm-hmm. The guilt is doesn't go away, especially when you're encouraged and persuaded to do things that go against the grain. You know, you can't see the wood for the trees. You're part of the problem. You need to listen to us as professionals. That happens a lot.
You're making them anxious, that your son or daughter's picking up on your anxiety. So, of course, he's not going to want to leave you because you're the anxious one. And I remember being in meetings, multidisciplinary meetings, where I was saying, well, of course I'm anxious. I'm absolutely desperate because this problem is becoming really chronic and nobody seems to be able to help. And we're being referred to stuff that is taking months, which in a child's lifetime is a significant amount of time when they're spiraling further into deeper crisis. So of course I'm anxious, because I'm being invited to meetings where we're having to really, you know, flagellate ourselves to kind of be seen, to be taken seriously. And also I think mental health difficulties at a primary level, I think primary schools have had an explosion. I think, you know, senior leaders in primary schools would agree that within the last 10 years, SATs, narrow curriculum, standard, you know, attainment going up, we had a meeting yesterday with a prominent MP, and she said, children, you know, really shouldn't be worrying about SATs. You know, it's nothing for them to worry about. And I said, if you look at neurobiology, children are hardwired to read the room, and they're hardwired to look to the adult in the room to know whether or not something is safe or achievable or whatever. And with the best friend in the world, teachers have got to get children through that year six exam, and they've got to prepare them for it. So in terms of that academic pressure, even if primary schools are creative about it, they are all children. I remember where I was in my spelling test in English when I was in year four. I know where I can remember where I got next to Susie on the next table. So these pressures that are sort of coming down on children, a reduction in play, there's so many factors that are contributing to anxiety and stress being woven into children's worlds at a much higher, younger age. And that's not their fault.
Yeah. So, I mean, you as an organisation, I mean, you've mentioned Not Finding School, which is kind of a very much a supportive environment. As a campaigning organisation, where do you even start trying to change what is a, you know, you talked about 750,000 children out of a national number of, what is 11 million, isn't it, give or take? That's a massive percentage. Yeah. Tell me your campaign goals and how you're going about that, because that's maybe something that people can throw their weight behind or behind. Voice behind, perhaps.
Well, that would be great. Oh, that would be great.
We're entirely self-funded at the moment. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, you'll get our checkbook out before we leave.
Yeah, we'll have a whip round.
Thank you. I suppose we work broadly in three areas. So we look at legislation and policy. I think trying to tackle this government head on is not going to work. But we talk to people who influence those things. We sit on APPGs and all that kind of thing. We also get involved in academic research because evidence is helpful, evidence of what works and what doesn't work. And we try and raise awareness through things like this and talking to the press. And we're quite keen to do some arts projects, a documentary or photographic exhibition, things like that, all to try and improve understanding. Yeah, because I think that's one of the problems, one of the key problems. And Ellie talked a bit about invisibility, and I think the reason that the other group is called Not Fine in School is because so many times you are told that your child is fine in school. And my daughter was a case in point, because a lot of these children, they don't want to be naughty. They want to stay under the radar. My daughter spent a lot of time making sure she stayed under the radar, answered what she thought people wanted to hear, was helpful and all the rest of it. And when you say, but the behaviour we see at home is very different, then it's seen as a problem at home.
Mm.
Yeah.
I went to a parents' evening where the teacher literally thought I was a different parent. So I'm so sorry. I thought we were talking about my daughter. I'm going, yeah, we are. But it was what they saw at school was so different from what we experienced at home that she literally thought I was the wrong parent. She was talking about the wrong child.
I saw this really brilliant meme the other day, a meme post thing, that said it was from a parenting website, and I'm sure we've all been told it, that sort of slightly accusatory child care situation, and it happens at school, where your little one, you turn up to collect them, and they see you and they burst into tears. And the comment is, oh, they were fine until you turned up. And I was just like, that is so true. That sort of encapsulates the sort of school refusal narrative as a parent, because it's almost like you turn up and you destabilize them and it's all your fault. Mm. Whereas actually what that is about is it is about the fact that the child was in survival mode, coping, fawning, getting on with just letting the time pass until you turned up, at which time they come to let it all out and co-regulate and need you to co-regulate with them. It's not that you're the bad penny that's disturbed them from their lovely time. So I think we need to go get right back to understanding how human beings work, how children work, because that education will help with understanding what is happening here. And it's all about, you know, we talk a lot about the importance of getting back to relationships with schools, you know, that we need to get back, move away from doing to, move towards doing with, stop asking what's happened here, what have you done, what's gone, you know, but actually, how can I help?
That is a huge issue across, you know, across all lots of communities, children with special educational needs, you know, children from in kinship arrangements, children who are in need. Do you think there's an element of other parents or other communities or other people going, well, our kids are fine. Is it just you? Do you think there is that narrative of actually it is, you know, we just need to get on with it? And is that part of your, you know, the square pegs push to kind of try and just alter this?
We think there's an awful lot of people who are just getting on with it because this is the way it's done. So if you talk, I would imagine that quite a few children in any class, if you said to them, how much do you love school and how much of the time do you love it? Or even adults, how did you feel about school? If I ask the majority of my friends, I've got a couple of friends who have said, I love school. Oh my God, I was so happy at school. I loved it. The majority of them were just like, it was okay. I had some good days. I had some bad days. It was all right. But it was kind of this sense of enduring it. You've just got to get through it because that's what everybody else does. And I think an awful lot of parents are literally trying to put one foot in front of the other, get up, go to work, get their kids to school, raise their children, get them through the exams, cast them off into the great blue yonder, you know. But there's this kind of sense that we're all on this conveyor belt, and part of what we're nudging at, and Fran and I explore this often, is the need, things have to change. the systems aren't working. Increasing numbers of children are struggling and becoming ill.
I mean, it's a big ask, isn't it, for you as an organisation to kind of take on the whole education system? Because that's effectively what... Is that effectively what you're saying you're going to do? I mean, I'm full of admiration for you. Having tried to push it... I've tried a little bit, but, you know, one school at a time. I mean, so Fran, do you have like specific aims of square pegs? Do you have a strategy? Can you share it, or is it secret? Is it subversive?
No, I think that our end goal is educational reform, and we have an initiative called School Differently, which is all about trying to pull together the many, many groups who also believe we should reform the education system. Some look at specific aspects like the curriculum or assessments. We think the whole thing needs a rethink, to be honest. So that's our kind of end goal. But in the meantime, because that's one huge challenge, we want to try and make life better for children who are experiencing it now. So by supporting school leaders, we have a book which we're in the process of pulling together. So trying to help school leaders who want to do the right thing but don't know which way to turn for their square pegs. Their hands are tied quite often by the system. And there are pinch points where there might be room to manoeuvre, and there are other places where they simply can't because their job's on the line or whatever. And it's very hard for parents to understand the position of a school leader, and that relationship is so important to find a solution to this. The relationship between parents and schools and teachers and staff is just crucial. Trust, compassion, relationship, that's what resolves these problems.
I mean, I think you've just really described some of the situations that adoptive parents and kinship carers and special guardians and foster carers find themselves in. I guess the great thing for us, and when I say great, I mean, it doesn't solve everything. We have virtual school heads who look after our children so they can get involved. I mean, it must be a very strange process to go through if you aren't a special guardian, an adopter, a foster care, a kinship care. I mean, where do you go for that little bit of help to get? I mean, is there anywhere, or is it just a case that you're expected to get on with it? I mean, don't get me wrong, I'm not saying that we're very lucky, because we have many, you know, many layers of issues as well, as, you know, I'm sure normal families do. But so, I mean, what is there? Is there anything? Who is her? At the end of my questions, I always like to give choices. I'm sorry.
I remember I joined a therapeutic parenting page, and I remember becoming distinctly aware that whilst the looked after children and the special guardian families and all the rest, I mean, special guardian families, my goodness, they get a rough deal as well. If you're an adoptive parent, you've got the adoption support fund. You know, there are sort of ports in the storm that are identifiable, I suppose, whether or not they deliver or, you know, but there are sort of ports in the storm. And if you're a foster parent, again, you know, there is a support framework that should be within corporate parenting at your LA. You know, there's mechanisms. I think for birth families who it's just horrendous, because it very quickly becomes a very scary shame blame game. And you quickly find yourself in a position which you absolutely didn't even see coming. You can't even conceive it, because I think the advantage of as a birth parent is that you have a certain sense of safety, that everyone respects your position at the table. But it very quickly, within that sort of early social care framework, if there's one professional at that multidisciplinary who just raises the flag that you are contributing or part of the problem, suddenly the lens shifts. And there's scare. I think it's, is it 25% of parents are accused of fabricating induced illness? Some really significant accusations can happen. And I think this sort of goes back to the fact that social care, which is the framework that every family can find themselves in, really needs to sort of, there's some real questions to ask about that approach. And it's about that doing with rather than doing to, and really being alert. Because when you are vulnerable and desperate and scared, and your child isn't able to do what all of your peers do, all of your peers' children do, or your comrades in the playground, to then be accused or questioned on top of it, it broke me completely. Yeah. It was the nail in the coffin for me emotionally. Psychologically, that finished me off.
And safeguarding is locked into school attendance. So the minute you have school refusal, you have a potential safeguarding concern. So it just, as Ali said, it adds an extra layer of distress on things.
And I imagine as well that a vulnerable, what would be classed as a vulnerable family, let's say, so, you know, perhaps, you know, our children may come from vulnerable families. The pressure that must put on them as well, you know, if you were strong, I mean, you both seem to me to be quite strong ladies in terms of being able to advocate for your children and stuff. But if you weren't that sort of person, I mean, that could put a lot of pressure on families.
Can you imagine if English wasn't your first language, or you had significant mental health difficulties or learning disabilities, or were a lone parent? You know, there's so many, and I think our definition of vulnerability absolutely needs to be as kept as broad, because anybody can become vulnerable at any time for any reason. So there are cohorts who are additionally vulnerable, but we all have needs. You know, I talk about this a lot. You know, I'm so tired of sort of the narratives of segregating that group over there with their high needs or their, you know, it's about just keeping it human and understanding that we all have needs. Some of our needs become higher, more acute, more chronic, more additional, you know, but they're all needs. And what needs to follow with that is a compassion focused approach, which again doesn't seek to divide and conquer or isolate, but actually brings families into the fold. And that applies to every service around the family. It's not just school.
So tell me how to get involved. Where can people find you and access the work that you're doing?
So on our website, there are lots of stats that give you information about the scale of the problem, how it compares to exclusions, mental health stats. We have campaigns. We have a map campaign where any parent, any family can anonymously put a pin in the map to represent the struggles that they're having, and they can say how long their child has been out of school for. That's been running since last September. There are only 4,500 pins in the scale of the problem, but consistently over 50% have been out of school for more than a year pre-pandemic. So the length of time that these children are off for, quite often getting no education, is just shocking. And I think we talked about the numbers of persistent absentees. When you look at the official data in terms of the reasons for absence, for 43% of those absences, there is no formal reason. So the codes that are used will describe other authorised absence or other unauthorised absence or possibly illness. But nowhere is there any sense of why these children are persistently absent. And it's just unbelievable, really.
Tell me what's the name of your website?
It's teamsquarepeg.org.
Right, thank you.
And not fine in school is not fine in school. .co.uk. They have a closed Facebook group for parents, which when we ask parents where have they found the most support, it will be groups like that, peer support from other parents. Because the most common phrase, Ellie will probably tell me, is, I'm not alone. Oh, my goodness. Mm. Yeah. You're joking. It's not just me. Mm.
Yeah. Yeah. You feel really on your own. So to find sort of, I found certain tribes in, you know, therapeutic parenting was a sort of, oh, okay, this is an approach that fits, that is effective. But also the not finding a school tribe was, oh, it was such a relief to know that we weren't the only ones. But the website has so many resources on it. You can follow us on Twitter. You can sign up to School Differently, schooldifferently.net. There are various channels to find us.
We also do.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Oh, she gone? It's Fran just
experience
frozen.
whether a child or parent. Have you got me?
Yeah.
On the map campaign page on our website, you can also find a link to leave a story. So a lot of parents tell us their experience. We've had a lot of children, young people, write on there as well. So I think we've got about 85 parent stories and quite a few children's experiences. I mean, just that's, to say how it was. Yeah.
Well, that's fantastic. And I think people, I think it's stark when you, I hadn't really, I'd never in my mind had a sense of the scale of the issue. I knew it was a common phenomenon within different communities, but that that is such a stark figure that it makes sense that if those families come together, they're a force to be reckoned with. So I guess I can understand exactly why you've set yourself up quite clearly to unify their voice. Not you know, support is essential, but sometimes those two can be not that compatible, not great bedfellows at times.
Not enough hours in the day.
There is that.
we have to change it. We can't just support people. We have to make a change. And that's what we were about.
Yeah. And I think, you know, we've been invited to do a bit, develop some training as well. So we're hoping to sort of deliver the awareness and the messages to the next generation of teachers who are in PGCEs. And I think it is an evolving discussion. And I think without a shadow of doubt, a lot of those who work in education, that they're as desperate and dumbfounded and don't know what to do either. And we're really, really keen to bring everybody to the same table, because those in education will talk to each other and those in social work will talk to each other. And it's actually about, okay, well, here's your service users who are failing the system and mucking up your stats. Bring us to the table as well, children and young people, but also other stakeholders. So we work with, you know, those who understand the law, you know, even just reminding everybody what their rights are and what should be happening is part of that conversation. Because the UK has some excellent laws in place for children and families. And, you know, it's just about sort of fostering the conversation, but we do a lot of talking and we're really keen to convert that to some actual meaningful change. That's next on the horizon for us.
Excellent. Well, we're at our time limit now. Scott hasn't got any more 50p to put in the meter. I know he's a man on a budget. Well, thank you so much for coming on to the webcast. I'm sorry about our little clunky start, but it's been really interesting.
It wasn't our fault. It wasn't
your fault. It was thrilling.
Yeah. It's the most fun we've had all day.
And
it was brilliant. Thank you.
Well, thank you for coming on, and hopefully people will be able to put their shoulders behind the wheel, as it were, and sort of and get involved, because I think it is a huge issue for our community, and maybe we can just add another voice to the thing. So yes, thank you very much for coming on.
Thank you for having us. It's been amazing.
Yeah.
No worries.
Yeah.
Bye.
Bye.